Hello, and welcome to the ninth night, I think it's the ninth night, of Millennial 2018. Now, this is it's going to be another busy night. Hold on a second, I'll tell you, it's going to be five people. 2 hours from now, it'll be Survive the Jive. I'm sure everyone's looking forward to that. And then Duke of Durham, and then Endeavour, and then JF. But first, Simon Harris. So, Simon Harris... I don't know when I first became aware of Simon. I think it was about a year ago now. And at that point, he was a civic nationalist. He'll correct the timeline if I'm wrong. And at the time, I didn't take much note of him because I just thought, okay, it's a civic nationalist. I know what they have to say. But then I came back again and thought, he's more curious, much more inquisitive than I had realized. And then a few months after that, I realized that he was getting himself into some bother with on certain matters that we don't need to go into here. But the point is that, I'll let you tell the story, Simon. Welcome to Millennial.
Well, thanks very much for having me on. It's great to be here. And as I said in my last email to you, you're holding up incredibly well. The stress of doing four or five interviews a night must be very, very tough. I don't think I could manage it.
I'm holding up so far. I think this is we're at the halfway mark, so okay. We'll see how we go.
Well, I've been aware of you for some time, actually. I became aware of you through Sargon, probably. Yeah, because as you say, I was a civic nationalist and I watched Sargon and Stephen Molyneux. And yeah, I mean, I was completely normie left, really. And that doesn't mean proper left. It was just kind of normie with the standard left-leaning ideas. And then I started looking into YouTube, and I discovered, Sargon and Stephen Molyneux, who I do consider to be gateways, right? They might also be gatekeepers for many people, but certainly both of them, for me, were gateways. And I remember, seeing a couple of your weird videos, this weird Scottish guy in the dark talking about things that I didn't really understand, I couldn't really relate to, quite a long time ago. And it wasn't actually that I came back to this part of the internet until the Crowds and Tea controversy. And I moved very quickly from the left through nationalism, through libertarianism, Brexit, Trump, counter jihad, and finally I got to you lot with the counter tea controversy, and I started realizing the political significance of race realism. And I'd already seen some of the Stephen Molyneux videos and Sargon's interview with Jared Taylor. But I suppose, I think you're right here. I am more curious in both senses of the word than many other people. And I was looking for the truth, really. So when I got to you lot, race realism made a lot of sense. And, it's kind of opened up my eyes to the realities we're living in.
Well, in terms of race realism and the truth, there is simply no reason why the races would be the same. And I mean, in fact, it would be extremely surprising if they were. And therefore, and couple that with the fact that we don't see any evidence that they are the same. So the obvious conclusion is that they're different and it's genetic as a result of divergent evolutionary paths. So that is really, it's just common sense.
Yeah.
And it's backed up by evidence and historical data and even genetic science today. So, there we are.
And I mean, so clear. I was talking to you before we went live on air about, I spent most of my 20s and early 30s playing, I played in punk bands, post-punk bands, and then I got into jazz, and then I got into African music and reggae. So I have spent a hell of a lot of time with black people. It's completely absurd. You don't have to be remotely antagonistic to realize that we're fundamentally different. We actually liked each other. I was the white guy in the band. We got on really well. I found the way to deal with them was just be straight, be forthright, be myself. I remember, actually, I'm not sure whether I can say this live on air. I used to make lots of apparently racist jokes, but they weren't racist because we were mates.
Right, it's a banter between friends. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember they always used to have a spliff after we finished the gigs, I wanted to get home early. It's about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd just taken two loads of amplifiers down a set of stairs, opened the van with the key myself, and they were still chatting up girls. And I shouted off.
Oh no! Hold on a minute! Don't say a racist joke on air.
No, I won't.
Okay, all right.
I won't actually use the word, but I said, I don't know where you got the expression "work like." You imagine the word I used, and they all turned around and laughed at me and slapped me on the back. And then some white guys came and accused me of being a racist. And the black guys all jumped in and said, "You know, don't hassle Simon. He's our mate. He's the guitar player in the band." So there's a way of dealing with
people. See, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, when you're honest with people and just straight with people, as you said. There's just so much more flexibility, you know. Like they know that, and it's actually the same now. I mean, even if you do think that there's an intelligence differential between Europeans and Africans, it doesn't mean that you hate them or dislike them or want anything bad to happen to a black person or black people as a totality. You know, so I don't really see. It's really just sort of stuck up white people and globalists who pretend that there's a big, you know, problem here, that there's a huge contradiction between thinking that the races are different and, whatever. I mean, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and obviously at this time in my life, we were in a shared project together. They taught me rhythm. I actually am an African, master African guitarist. I can really play this stuff. But I gave them pop sensibility. Basically, the second album we made, I co-wrote the whole second album because they couldn't have got that, you know, this English pop idea were it not for me. And I couldn't have got the rhythm. We couldn't have created this without this combination. That doesn't mean we created a hybrid. That doesn't mean you have to jump into bed with people. That doesn't mean that we're not different. But you know, and I'm a race realist. I was a race realist back then. And we spoke very openly about our differences. And it was, I think it's the globalist attitude, the leftist champagne socialist attitude is completely unrealistic.
So what did you do in between then and when you, discovered YouTube a few years ago? I mean, what politically were you during that time?
Well, I mean, I suppose I was a default lefty because I hung around with black people. You know what I mean? And then when I gave up music because my daughter was born, I became a teacher, which is kind of which means in order to fit in, things are even worse. I never really thought about it. And there's someone in the chat, and we can talk about it either now or later. But I became aware of Catalan nationalism. And I wrote two books about Catalonia. The first one's Going Native in Catalonia, the process of adapting. So I'm kind of really interested in the topics that we're talking about. It's kind of living on this interface between cultures. Because I've lived here in Barcelona for 30 years. That I'm 58. That's more than half my life. I speak Catalan well enough that people don't know that I'm not Catalan. You know, I'm on my second Catalan partner. I've got a Catalan daughter.
But so, how did you end up there in the first place?
My brother was teaching. I'd had a bit of a. I'd got a grant to Berklee School of Music in Boston. I'd got a place. I'd been through all the auditions at all the music schools. Ilya had given me a grant. And then A week before I was about to leave, they sent me a letter saying your grant is under review. I wanted to be a musician, and I wanted to write film scores, ideally. Popular, jazzy, you know, like Hill Street Blues, that kind of thing, probably with more guitar in it. And a week before I was about to leave, I got the place, I got everything sorted out, I got a flat in Boston, and they sent me a letter saying your case is under review because we consider it not a necessary kind of study, and I'd already done a psychology degree. This is your second degree. Music, what the hell's that, mate? Your case will come under review in March. And when it came under review, they decided I hadn't got the grant. My life had hinged on this. I was 28 years old. My life had hinged on this, and everything went AWOL. And my brother was here in Barcelona teaching English for just a year. So I said, I came out for a holiday. I got laid 3 times in 2 weeks, and I thought it was sunny. Sorry about that, folks, but I was a lot younger then and better looking. I saw the option of teaching English for a while, and I was going to give up music, but then I got back into playing in African bands anyway. So that's how I came here. And then, because I was playing music, I first started playing with with Spanish and Catalan bands. When I couldn't speak any of the language, I could communicate with people with my guitar. And back in 1988, British-style music wasn't very well known. You know, globalization hadn't really set in yet. So I was quite a coveted commodity. Because I could sing in English, I could play pretty much anything from Led Zepp to the Sex Pistols. So I was a kind of handy person to have in the band. And so I very, very quickly, I ended up, my group of friends ended up not being English. And that's it. That's I don't know whether this hasn't got a lot to do with the...
No, with, but it's nationalist politics, really. No, but I've always wondered, what were you like before you arrived into this, because I didn't know that you were a lefty as such, but I guess you weren't really. I mean, you were sort of a centrist who just had lefty leanings because that's what was in the air.
I never really questioned it. I'd never analysed it, and I wanted to be nice, and I had friends of different cultures, And also the interesting thing is I left England in 1988. And so I left a kind of idealized England. And the problems of mass immigration didn't start here at all until the late 90s. So my capacity for observation was much, much later. And every time I went back to the UK, I'd kind of see odd things, but you're there for 10 days. And if you've been living in another place for so long, it's completely impossible it was impossible for me to update my view of England. I live here. I belong here now. But my roots are there. So I wasn't aware. I've now become very conscious of my Englishness and aware of ethnic and racial identity and things you can't change about yourself. But I was kind of floating along in my hippie, happy way, not questioning anything. And it's only really from the late 90s, I began to see mass, greater immigration here. And I began to talk without questioning my supposed leftism. I began to talk to people about they're creating an underclass here. This was very, very clear. There was a neighborhood very close to where I lived that had been all Andalusian immigrants. And within about 3 years, it was all black, Moroccan, and South American immigrants. And I remember searching around trying to make sense of this without ever properly analyzing it. I was busy. I was being a dad. I was working.
And it sounds like you saw it in left-wing terms as well still. I mean, like economics, like they're creating an underclass.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I viewed it. And And it's kind of quite interesting. Occasionally I get people who I consider idiots on my videos telling me, I'm really angry with you. It took you 50 years to wake up. You know, I mean, everybody comes to their realizations when they come to their realizations. Life takes its course. And I think my view of my role in all this is, yeah, there's nothing wrong with having a base boomer, actually, and someone who's woken up and come to this very, very late. There's plenty of us.
I completely agree. And you know, just don't take those comments to heart. There'll be people, you know, rubbing it in and stuff. But it's, you know, it's the usual bants. I think that everyone's glad to have, you know, another person awakened to this stuff.
Yes. I mean, yeah, I don't take these things to heart. But it just, you know, it's one of these things that kind of tires you out.
Yeah, I know.
You kind of make you respond with some kind of snidey comment, and then think, this is my channel, and I should be a little bit more adult and responsible than this. So you don't bother responding. But there's a lot of there's kind of a lot of negativity around here.
Well, I try to discourage that in my channel. I really do, because especially during millennial, because to me it's a time for, you know, goodwill and coming together and all that. But even on my channel in general, I think it's very important to discourage that kind of thing, because who wants to be miserable all the time and looking for reasons to fall out with people and not collaborate with them and not talk to them? You know, we need all the help we can get. We need all the solidarity we can get. So that's something I take a very hard line on, because there's just so much of that about, you know, the pessimism, the resentment, the looking for something to be frustrated at, to direct your frustration at. And I'm not having a go at the person in the chat, whoever it was who said this. This is just a general thing. You know, it's a general point that I'm making here. And I've said it before elsewhere. It's just, we need to get over this. We really need to get over this and be a community that other people want to be a part of, quite frankly.
Yeah, and I think this ties in. We mentioned earlier that I'm quite happy to talk about this. I think we need to be a very broad church. You know, we're broadly, we're in favour of our own people. We're in favour of our traditions. We want to keep the West as we believe it should be. A lot of the minor differences. One of the people I like a great deal, you had him, the Great Order, Jared George. When he was speaking to JF, who you've got on later, he actually pointed out the differences that the two of them had. And he said, but essentially, and he pointed them out very, very clearly, but essentially, we're all on board the same train. So these aren't things that should divide us. The essence of the movement, in the broadest sense of the word, should unite us without us bickering about ridiculous things that are, you know, there's a lot more important things to be getting on with.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that will probably happen as more people come on board anyway, because the sort of intransigent types who don't want the movement to expand will be sort of, frankly, drowned out. For one of them, I don't like saying that because it's not nice, but I think that as this process happens, it will just happen. Because there will be more people from an old left background, there'll be more boomers, etc., and other backgrounds. So I think it's just going to happen. The key thing is that we all are heading in the right direction here, not, you know, where we came from. And yeah. Also, as you say, the minor differences that really just don't matter. You know, our enemies don't care about this stuff. They just work together and get things done. And I really wish that we could learn that lesson, because we just don't have time to piss around.
I don't know if you've seen in the news, but I don't know if you know the German party, Die Linke, which are a left-wing party.
Yeah, it's a Turkish identitarian party, isn't it?
No.
Oh, no, sorry, that's Denk. Denk.
Yeah, Denk in Holland, Die Linke, I mean, I haven't really looked into this properly, but I just, one of my friends on Facebook or perhaps Gab posted that Die Linke have now got, and they're lefties, they're full-on lefties, but they've got an anti-immigration program.
Yes. And there was one other millennial, somebody brought this matter up. We're talking about the left beginning to become not only acceptant of white identity politics, but cognizant of the fact that mass immigration causes dreadful economic strife for lots of people, not just the immigrants, but the native whites as well. So basically, there are left-wing reasons to be anti-mass immigration and anti-multicultural, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, see, this is what I think. I'm not sure whether I've completely unloaded my essential leftism in the sense of wanting to stand up for justice, wanting people to be not equal, not some kind of levelist attitude. Another thing that I've talked about quite a lot is I'm from Nottingham, so I've always seen the Robin Hood story. The Robin Hood story for me is an identitarian story, and it's about steal from the rich to give to the poor. Is steal from the Normans and the tax-collecting tribe that they brought over with them at the same time to give to the Anglo-Saxons. It's an identitarian thing. And I'm from the north of the city, and I'm an identitarian Anglo-Saxon. And I was when I was 16, 17. My grandma used to say in the south of the city, which we consider kind of no man's land, my grandma used to call West Bridgford Bread and Lard Island, because they're so stuck up down there that they can't afford, and they spend so much money on their curtains that they can't afford to put butter on their bread, and they eat bread and lard because they're bloody Normans down there, they are. And I mean, she used to say this, and actually until 1919 there were two boroughs of Nottingham. So when people, I have a kind of Northern English identity, and people tell me that I'm a Southerner because Nottingham was about as far south as you can get. But actually, I've always had this kind of frontier mentality because we've lived this Anglo-Saxonism that perhaps this is going a little bit weird for you.
No, I was just thinking
my Anglo-Saxon identity is important to me.
Yeah, that, it's not too weird at all. I'm just thinking, where would I place your accent? And it definitely does sound softly northern. I mean, it's not, you know, Newcastle or Liverpool or anywhere specific, in fact. But it does sound northern to me. I just assumed you were from, I don't know, somewhere like Stockport or something.
Well, I was born and brought up in Nottingham. Then I spent my adolescence in Cheshire, in Woollybak Land. So I've always looked north. My identity is north of the Trent. And kind of going back to treating other people, other races. The reason why I've been able to integrate so well here is I've never given an inch on my identity. I've always been Simon from Nottingham. I've been here 30 years. It's ridiculous. And I've always used that as my escape clause, nobody will ever touch anything about my identity. I have zero tolerance.
So 1 minute you're, hello, my fellow Catalans. And then the next minute, I'm from Nottingham, kind of thing.
Well, no, because I'm an adopted Catalan.
I'm just bouncing. I'm just joking.
Yes, I know. But people think I've become something else. No, the way to survive actually is to always be yourself. And going back to dealing with the black guys, the reason why they love me so much is I was unmovable. You know, I was this. This is what you're dealing with.
I think you're absolutely right. As I said earlier, if people know that you're not trying to trick them and you're not talking down to them and so on, they respect you because they feel respected themselves. You know, it's a straightforward situation. It's when the champagne socialist type who's desperately tying himself in knots not to say that thing or not to come across that way, that's transparent and it's obvious. And it's irritating. It's annoying.
Yeah, totally. I've got no more to say on that topic, actually.
Well, I mean, I think it's an important point to make, because life can be simple if you keep it simple in that sense, you know, or at least social relations can be simple.
Yeah, and I suppose when I talk about being leftism, being lefty, I was always aware of who I was and what my roots were. Tradition was already always important. And I suppose the big problem, what's happened over the last decade, is things have just gone completely mad. There was a time, I mean, my granddad was actually quite an important trade union leader. He was president of the East Midlands Division of the Transport and General Workers Union. Looking back on him, it's very sad. I think he was probably wrong. But he was still a really nice bloke. And he was still one of these people that stood up for his workers and was completely honest. And this is the tradition I come from. Blue-haired feminists and, you know, transgenderism and the current madness has nothing to do with the basic. Something I sometimes wonder about the alt-right, particularly Richard Spencer, when he talks about the restoration of the white aristocracy. I don't know about that, really. I'm not sure whether the white aristocracy could have been, were completely trustworthy in the Middle Ages. I think ordinary people have been getting screwed for quite some time, whether the tribe has been present or not.
Well, that is that's a huge topic. You know, I think the notion of hierarchy is reassuring to people in actually all sorts of different people. The question is, how is it, how does it develop and thus get implemented organically or artificially? And then how do they see themselves in relation to each other? How does the elite, if there has to be an elite, and I think in basically every situation there does have to be an elite, then how does the elite conceive of the rabble or the hoi polloi or whatever you want to call them, the general public? That's a crucial question. But I think that there does have to be an elite, because it's simply the case that, even if we had totally the same IQ level, if everyone in a society had the same IQ level, there would still need to be some people who are making the decisions so that everyone else didn't have to do it. So it would be then established by... The elite would be identified by their level of education or their level of common sense or whatever their experience is, or even just random. But I think there have to be some people who are given this responsibility or who take it for whatever motivations for the sake of simplicity and so that everyone else doesn't need to deal with it. Because
no,
most people don't want to deal with this stuff. And that's the thing. That's why democracy is kind of a bit of a joke.
Yeah, I'm certainly not questioning the necessity for hierarchy, but it's a question of you have to have shared values, and this is I'm going to throw out another massive topic, but as I go, I'm not kind of there yet. Rocking Mystery has come out as a Christian, but there's an ethics behind Christianity. There's a way of treating people. And, you know, when everybody in a society has the same values, then that makes, that means that the people at the top of the hierarchy have a sense of responsibility to people at the bottom of the hierarchy. The more atomized, and I don't mean atomized in the sense of individualism, but if you've got a bunch of Muslims, a bunch of Hindus, a bunch of New Agers, everybody with disparate value systems, then
it doesn't even sound like a good idea. It doesn't even sound like it's going to work. It even on the face of it sounds like this is going to be disastrous. It's going to be extremely complicated to maintain in the meantime. But even then, it is going to be heading inexorably towards conflict, because it's just baked in, you know.
Yeah.
Diversity equals division, even if you can sort of kid yourself about that for a while.
Yeah, and this is where we're going, and it's. But at the same time, as we were talking about earlier, It's important not to fall into the trap of encouraging or pushing for that conflict. We can't really go deeply into the issue of who is behind this, but just as the black people, you kind of look around the world and look at the state of the Muslim world. It's not surprising that former colonies and parts of the world that are having the shit bombed out of them blame a certain group, and when you all of a sudden stick them in our communities, they're going to be resentful.
This is why it's so ridiculous that we've actually got a phrase, an expression, invade and invite. And have you heard that?
I hadn't heard that before, no.
Oh, I heard it quite a few times. And then I heard Hillary Clinton saying it as well. And it should be a given that, I don't know what she was talking about, maybe Syria, that we will invade Syria, but then we'll also invite them to Europe so that, you know, so that we don't leave them to deal with a war zone and a crumbled infrastructure and so on. We'll help them, but we'll help them by inviting them to live in our societies, not by, you know, helping them to rebuild their own. Because the double farce here is that there was no reason to pulverize their society in the first place anyway. It's just, but we don't need to go into the reasons why they wanted Syria. But the point is that let's assume that the war is completely just and you've got a good reason to go to war with someone. Is it a good idea to then invite them to live in your own society? Or is that not just obviously insane?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously insane, and it's a deliberate being deliberately set up for conflict. And the point is, and kind of going back to this issue of not having to hate anybody, I would be much happier if the Middle East was a peaceful zone where they could all prosper and be themselves. And I mean, what bugs me really, I don't want Eid festivals here. I don't want a mosque around the corner, and I particularly don't particularly want to eat Muslim food. Really, I want to be able to do what I like, and what I like comes naturally out of me. The great thing about living here in Catalonia, the differences between the English and the Catalans, once you've overcome the language barrier, they aren't massive really. And so, I mean, I'm kind of hard line about this. Sounds absurd because I live in a different country, but I don't do anything foreign. I just don't participate in foreign things. So I don't eat foreign food. I don't watch foreign music. Or outside my own cultural sphere. So I can consider my own cultural sphere principally English and Catalan, and then anything by extension European. I'm actually not interested in anything else. It doesn't awaken my attention. Why on earth should I, when I live in a country with brilliant food and brilliant wine, why should I go for a curry? And it's bizarre.
I know what you mean. It is kind of what you're talking about here is checking out of the multicultural or diversity thing. The buffet, the incredible range of restaurants, just doesn't. You're sort of saying, well, it might be nice, but why bother? And also, what you're saying is that there's a certain moral. I don't know what would you say, a moral indulgence, moral failing in partaking of these things, because it just encourages more of it to happen.
Yeah, and also if you don't support the local cuisine and the local culture, it will die out. It will be, the invasion will win, and it will all mold in. I've said this often before. One of the interesting things about living in a different country is you live and stay in a different country out of choice. I chose to come here. So I've had to think very hard about why I stay here. Yes, I know sometimes I regret it. Sometimes I think it would be great to be at home. But when I think hard and fast about it, There are plenty of things I love about the culture here. I don't want it to turn into a muddy brown Brick Lane or Bradford, which is exactly the same as the whole of the rest of Europe is going to be. No, what I find special about it, I still enjoy. I mean, I talked about being very, very integrated and being very part of it, but at the same time, I can stand back and it's still kind of alien. It's still kind of, even 30 years on, it's still odd in a way that Nottingham now actually is, because it's been invaded.
Well, yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? There's no home, really.
Yeah, and again, this makes you reflect, and particularly now my home has been lost. There's no way where to go back to, because I talked earlier about having this idealized view of what England was. I left in 1988. I can't update it. When I think of England, I can see as many television pictures and videos as I like, but it doesn't stop being the England that I left back then. And even after a week's holiday in London, that's just a week's holiday in London. My inner memories, my fundamental memories of the place are still of the place I left, which was mainly white, 95% white back then, and 95% us.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, indeed. I mean, would you like to talk about the situation in Britain just now? I mean, how often do you come back to Britain?
Well, but very rarely, since, okay, both parents are dead now. Once that kind of umbilical cord has been cut, there are very few, and my brother stitched me up on the inheritance from my dad, so it's kind of a bit, I've kind of got plenty of friends on Facebook, but I haven't been back for two years. Yeah, I don't go back very often. I've got a best mate in London, and I kind of go back again. But there's not much point. There's not any great reason to go back. I'm kind of very happy and comfortable here. My world is here.
What about your kids? Do they have any connection to Britain, or have you just sort of gone full, Catalan with them?
Yeah, pretty much full. Since my mother died, the connection is with Britain is very, very limited. I'm actually separated from my first wife, with whom I have my influence on my children is much more limited. So I have much less say on. Yeah, they speak decent English. They kind of like English things. They've got cousins there, and go and visit them every now and again. But their identity is primarily here.
Right. Yeah, it's probably simpler to do it.
I think so.
Do it that way. Yeah. Do you ever regret that you didn't have an English family?
No. It wouldn't have made sense. I wouldn't have stayed. If I'd had an English family, I would have gone back.
Of course, it's funny, isn't it? It's like saying, well, do I wish I was a different person? No, because then I wouldn't be this person.
Yeah, I am. Life went this. There are kind of moments when I regret. And you, kind of going back to the 1980s when globalism and traveling around and living in other countries was much more exciting and adventurous, and kind of you felt like the vanguard of something. When I came to Barcelona, the number of English speakers, and I don't want to be crass. Well, I'll be crass. But you got laid so easily being English. It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing.
Because in those days, it would be more of a novelty, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
An English guy, because now it's, everyone travels everywhere.
Yeah, and it was great. It was an easy life. It felt successful. It's only once you get older when you think about the consequences and you realize that changing your fundamental identity is impossible. And it's kind of these whole things about intelligence and identity and genetics becoming more real the older you get. And it's not as if I'm on any kind of moan. I'm very happy, centered, relaxed. But I don't. I'm part of my journey has been realizing that I not even I really belong here. And it's kind of a tough realization. I'm going to stay here. There's nowhere to go back to. And this is what I think is the case with anyone who moves somewhere else. It's the same with the pseudo-refugees who are coming now. They don't belong here because they don't have the same attachment to the land. When they dream, it's very, very, it's an interesting question. It's ask yourself, where would you like to be buried?
I've wondered that. I've really wondered that. Because the question is at home, but then you haven't gone anywhere. You know, you haven't become something. Well, that's one way to look at it. You know, another way to look at it is you didn't need to become something as such. You already were, and you can grow and so on at home. So that's the other thing. But then the other part of it is, even if you did go and travel and end up in a different city, a different country, you should still go home at the end. You know, they're to go full circle, as it were. I mean, there are two sort of ways of looking at this, and I don't know. I can't decide.
Yeah, I mean, the case for me, we're getting kind of it's getting very intimate here, but there's nowhere to go back to, and there are people I love here. So, but here, yeah, this is one of the things that bugs me a lot. I would like to be in a churchyard, in an English country churchyard, for the rest of eternity. That's where I would like to be. But what here, they have walls with graves with holes in them where they put the bodies. And there's something repugnant about them.
Yes, yes, I've seen the same in Italy.
Yeah, and I just, there's something that doesn't connect with me. And when you start asking yourself those kind of questions, you're really analyzing your fundamental identity. It's where did you come from? Where will you end up? I won't end up probably in the right place, but that's, you know, that's life. It won't have been such a terrible journey, but it is something you really reflect on. And yeah, this is the whole, there's nothing hateful about belonging. Belonging is very realistic. So the Muslims that are being thrown out of the Middle East, or the Africans that are coming up from Saharan Africa, they don't really belong here. This is why they behave badly.
Oh, I mean, it's so, and it's such a sort of cold economic thing, reasoning why they're here. Whether you talk about globalists who, you know, transport them over to Europe, or their own reasons for being here. I mean, we know it's not safety because they travel through multiple countries. They don't stop at the first safe country, so that's bollocks. It's really just cold material reasons why they're in Europe and any particular European country. The whole, well, you're right. I mean, simply to put it simply, they just don't belong here.
Mm. Yes, this is very much my view, and yeah. We kind of began this conversation talking about how I got here. I kind of got here analyzing my own feelings about identity. I think there are things that you can't change, and it's unrealistic to think you can. And possibly it would be nice. I'm not as optimistic as Greg Johnson. I listened to your very interesting conversation with Greg Johnson. I'm not as optimistic as he is about successfully pushing back globalization and there being a nationalist uprising or nationalist, I don't know what the correct word is, a nationalist resurgence, that's the word. But even if there is, there's a kind of generation of people who, and to a certain extent, my generation, who were hoodwinked into believing that this was I mean, this is prior to Schengen. This was all great and wonderful, and we can open up the borders, and we can all live together. And yeah, I kind of left the UK 10 years before the noxious symptoms of globalism could be properly seen. Yes, there'd been riots of various ethnic groups in the UK, but it is post 1996, post Tony Blair in the UK, and bizarrely round about the same time here. And it's interestingly exactly the same time as the Barcelona Declaration, which I'm sure plenty of the listeners have heard about, this kind of mutual agreement between Europe and North Africa, making living and working in Europe for North Africans much easier, and Schengen. So it's a kind of double whammy. And then since then, the last 22 years or so, we've really seen the results of this. Prior to that, I don't think it's unrealistic that I was an idealist, that I thought the world would be beautiful, and we'd been sold this vision of a happy, globalist, peaceful world. It's only once you get it shoved in your face that you see the problems inherent in it.
And there are people who still don't see the problems. I mean, there are people older than you, people I know, who still don't realise that something really serious is going on.
No.
It's quite amazing.
It's amazing.
But it means that you can understand why they don't see it, because it would mean going against 50, 60 years of what they've believed, and the, you know, the beliefs that defined them, that distinguished them from their parents, their grandparents. So you can understand why they just don't want to do it. But you know, after Cologne and after Rotherham, you know, to me, is I just don't know how anyone can think that this is okay, or that it's going to work out well.
No, and as a boomer, somebody in the chat is talking to me about me being the eternal boomer. What do you want me to do at this? Yes, I am a boomer, obviously, but I'm a boomer that's woken up to this and had to go through the grim reality of realizing that 90% of what you've believed throughout your life has been a lie, and we've been fooled. And if the importance of waking up is that you wake up, is that your view changes. And I suppose what I think my potential contribution is, I don't want to exalt myself all too much, but I get a lot of very positive comments, and I get some criticism for being a boomer, but I also get some very positive comments. There's quite a lot of middle-aged ladies on my channel who are definitely woke to this kind of thing. And if you can stress to people that you can become aware of things at any time, the important thing is to become aware of them, and then become an activist, use as much energy as you can to change people's minds, be it through internet, through social media, or much to a much greater extent on a personal level. You know, I kind of, my Catalan friends are kind of very, very cooked, really. But I kind of do as much as I possibly can to talk about the reason why you're losing this battle is because you've lost the demographic battle. It's all about demographic. Demographics is destiny, particularly if you've got democracy. So if you really, I'm not going to go deeply into the whole issue of Catalan nationalism now, because that's a whole hour and a half. But if they really want this, then they don't want Muslims and black people here, because the only way to get them on, foreigners on their side, is by bribing them. And if I look through the English community here, out of probably 100 English people that I know, only two or three speak Catalan. I mean, it's appalling. So it's a demographic battle. The more people from anywhere you invite into your territory, the more you're losing the demographic battle. And it's not just a question of colour of skin or race even. It's a question of blood and soil. I know it's a much purloined term, but yeah, your blood, your genetics are allied to a particular territory, and the way you're most likely to be loyal to it is if you're really from there.
I don't think that. I think that people should understand that it does take a lot of effort to come to grips with these facts when you're constantly being told the opposite.
Yeah.
It is. There was something you said earlier. That's a long life out there. About the blood and soil, and what was it you said? I've forgotten what the point was that you made there, because I was watching the chat.
There's a demonstration going on outside.
All right. I should ask what the demonstration's about, perhaps.
Well, this is about Catalan nationalism. I'll mention this very, very quickly. And the way the powers that be create conflict, there has been planned here a big Catalan nationalist demonstration for Friday. So all the spirits are, and we live very close to a government building. And this is what's happening outside the window now. I'm kind of used to it and don't consider it particularly important. But for a month and a half, they've known that the demonstration will be on December the 21st. What day has the Spanish president decided to come to Barcelona? Spanish president, prime minister, really, decided to come to Barcelona to have talks with the Catalan government on Friday. It's such a blatant manipulation. It's creating conflict in order that things like the broader terms of immigration, and perhaps we'll have to have another hangout one of these days so I can talk about things like Vox and the growth of the various kinds of nationalism here in Spain. But it's definitely a tactic to create conflict between a brother war, divert attention from the other more nefarious things that are going on in Spanish society.
Yeah, indeed, and the stoking of conflict. I mean, as we were saying earlier, invade and invite, that kind of thing, it is only going to lead to conflict. The powers that be must know that, and therefore they must be doing this deliberately. And the implications of that are pretty terrifying.
Yeah, and they will stoke conflict wherever they can possibly find it, I think.
I think the other sort of important thing that's come from this conversation is you've said several times, there are fundamental things about your identity that you just cannot change. Mm-hmm. And it took you decades, to the age of 55 or so, to realize that, because you'd been, the milieu, the generational, the cultural milieu said that everything is malleable.
Yeah. And fundamentally, it isn't.
All right. Well, let's leave it at that.
Yeah.
I think that's been about 40, 45 minutes. So, excellent. Well, should talk about the website briefly, European Freedom.
Yeah, it's europeanfreedom.com. European Freedom. It's freedom from Europe, from the EU, from the controllers. Use as many brackets as you like. It's freedom for European peoples. I kind of obsess with certain things. It's got the main blog, which I write on principally. It's also got a forum, which is forum.europeanfreedom.com. Everybody's very welcome to join. Much as Jared George, the Great Order, says, if you join up, you don't need to be too involved, but you get on a mailing list so that if something goes down, then you've got another way of getting in touch with other people. There's a private messaging system. I've also got a wiki. And I've recently got into publishing. I've written two books on Catalonia, but now the topic is Yeah, the hidden hand. What I'm doing is republishing old texts that are in the public domain, editing them, making them a little bit more acceptable, writing an introduction. And it's the broad topic of Illuminati, Jesuits, Masons, and the tribe. And that's because something, one of the topics that you've dealt with quite a lot is or lots of people deal with, is the First World War being a turning point in European history. I'm kind of more interested, obviously, the lead up to the First World War, but that time between the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution, I think is really interesting. And the various uprisings that occurred throughout the 19th century, where did they come from? How were the stable systems, the stable national systems, broken down? And how did that lead to the early part of the 20th century? So that's the aim of the publishing project. And I published one book whose name I'm not going to mention, but you can check out on my website. Keep an eye on me. I'm doing stuff. I'm not very disciplined about making videos. A little bit like you, I make videos when I have the energy to do so. And sometimes I've stopped for a while because I think I need to do more research. But I'm always doing.
It's clear that a lot of research goes into your videos. So I assumed that you would do that. You'd do a slew of videos and then go off and do lots of research and then, you know, sort of renew your muse that way.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I have to do. And people worry about me and say, where have you gone? I don't want to produce drivel, really. I want it to be thoughtful. I want it to be considered. I want it to help people's. Fundamentally, I want it to help my learning process just as much as anybody else's learning process. I want to get somewhere with this, and kind of following the news cycle, coming up with simple excessively simple analyses of things doesn't do any good for me, and doesn't do any good for want of a better word, the movement at large.
Okay, excellent. Well, the links will be in the description box below, so please have a look. In the meantime, I think we'll end it here. So, Simon Harris, thank you for taking part in Millennial 2018.
Well, thanks very much for having you. Pleasure.
I was looking forward to this one. I think I've been wanting to talk to you for ages, actually. So it was nice to finally get the chance.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll be back in about 40, 50 minutes with Survive the Jive. So I will see you all then. Bye for now. All right, I'll end it now. I just want to get those sirens in. See you.